war on the motorists. This is about readjusting priorities. London's been designed for decades around private car use. Yep. We can't continue to see the growth in private vehicles. There just simply isn't enough space. It's madness for the economy. It's madness for the environment. It's madness for the health of the city.
Welcome to Calling All Stations, the transport podcast. I'm Christian Walmart, an author and journalist who has covered transport for the past 30 years. In every episode, we try to keep you up to date with the most engaging news stories, policy developments, and interviews in the transport world. And with me is my regular co-presenter, Mark Walker, who has spent decades looking at transport policies and legislation. So, Mark, what are we covering today?
Hello, Christian, and hello to our listeners. In each episode of Calling All Stations, we usually have one featured interview. But in this particular episode, we actually have two. And the second of them will be with Steve White, who's the managing director of Southeastern Trains, who's been working with an organisation called the Purpose Coalition to promote social inclusion and social mobility in the rail industry. But the first of your interviews is with Dr. Will Norman, who's the Walking and Cycling Commissioner at the Greater London Authority.
Oddly enough, despite doing this podcast for more than a year, I've hardly covered cycling in it, despite the fact I am a lifelong cyclist and use my bicycle to get around London virtually every day of the week. So I thought it was a time to catch up on the issue, and who better to talk to than Will Norman, who's the Cycling Commissioner for Transport for London, and has been in the job, I think, about 5 or 6 years?
It's now 7 years.
Seven years.
I don't want to correct you, but it is walking and cycling.
And walking and cycling.
I think that is a really important distinction.
Okay, right. So, I'll start you with an easy one. What actually do you do, Will?
I'm not sure that is an easy one. My job, what is it? It's Ron Seal, that does what it says on the tin.
Right.
You know, my job is essentially, how do we get more Londoners to walk and cycle more? How can we get people to switch their trips,
right,
particularly local trips, from car journeys and unnecessary car journeys to walking and cycling more as everyday life? For a number of reasons. It keeps people healthy, it's good for, it alleviates congestion, and essentially it's just good for the city.
Right, okay. And have you been at all successful in this in the last 7 years?
I think we've had successes. I think that we could, you know, there is still an awful lot more to do. So when I started, so I look back to the 7 years through the mists of time, there were about 90 kilometres of sort of high quality cycleway in London. We now have over 350. So that's almost the four times.
And that's properly segregated.
It's not all segregated. Right. And so one of the things I think which was very important was, rather than defining a route saying this route will all be segregated or all be on quiet roads, it's actually saying, well, actually the route we need is from A to B.
Right.
What is the most appropriate way of doing this? Along main roads, busy roads, you definitely need that protection. It's absolutely vital, both to keep existing cyclists safe, but to encourage new people to cycle. But
right,
we also have a lot of quieter roads, and how do we use those properly as part of the network? But the key thing is there's ensuring they're quiet. Yep. So that's where filtering roads come in, low traffic neighbourhoods, etc., etc., so that you actually can make sure that those quieter routes are quiet and safe, and again, attractive for people.
Okay, but this is not about infrastructure. It's all very well giving figures in terms of, oh, we've got, you know, several hundred extra kilometres.
Yeah.
It's in terms of usage. So are Londoners, visitors to London, cycling more?
Yes, it's quite remarkable the change we've
seen.
So
to what
I
extent?
Think now we've got 1.26 million journeys on an average day in London, bike journeys. Now that's, you think about that, that's about a quarter of all bus journeys, a third of all tube journeys. Yep. So it's this nonsense that cycling is a hobby for the minority.
Right.
It's just not true. It is a very, very core mode for a lot of people to get around. Yeah.
Right.
There is still significant potential for more people to do that, to cycle as part of their everyday lives. And I think that's the sort of the next focus.
So who are these cyclists? I mean, are they all older white men like me, or indeed young white men, or are they reasonably diverse? I mean, how does that break down?
So I don't, off the top of my head, I don't know the exact breakdown of the data, but I think what has happened is that historically, where you built cycle routes coming into the centre of towns, particularly into the centre of the city, you attracted people who work in the centre of the city to cycle. Yeah. Right. And lo and behold, if you look at a city like London, in fact, most sort of central business districts, they are largely affluent white men. Yeah. Okay. As part of that, and lo and when you build that, those people come and use it. So we have, and historically, London has been very, cyclists have been very much dominated by white middle-aged men, maybe slightly older than middle-aged now. I think what's been really interesting is watching the change as you provide that network of safer cycleways, how that enables other people. So we're seeing a big increase in women cycling across the city. Where we are building infrastructure in communities with more ethnic diversity, we are seeing more ethnic diversity on the cycleways. And this is not rocket science. If you build routes where people use them and in communities where people live, they choose to use them. You do need to do a bit more to encourage that diversity, I think. It's not just about building cycle routes, as you said, and the number of kilometres. You know, who are the champions? Who's talking about this in those communities? And once you get, you know, who are the role models? Who are the big kids getting kids to do it or families to cycle? Suddenly, once you've got that, it begins to increase exponentially.
Right. And how do you do that? I mean, is that TfL doing some of that type of work, kind of... not just building the infrastructure, but also promoting stuff?
I think this is there is no, I wish there was a silver bullet, one organization could just go bang, this is how we do it. But just, it's too complex for that. This is all about partnership. So TfL have a really key role to play, but so do the boroughs. The boroughs are vital partners in the delivery of this, both in terms of, well, they control 95% of London's roads. Yep, so you can't do anything strategically in London without working with borough partners. But also I think, you know, everybody talks about TfL, everybody talks about the boroughs. I think the slightly underloved piece is the role of campaigners and communities in this. And I think that's where we're seeing huge change. All of this change is dependent on people asking for change, people demanding change, people campaigning for this. And so what we've done in terms of addressing the diversity is that we work with those boroughs. We're seeing new boroughs sort of coming into the fold, as it were. We've been used to having Hackney and Camden and Waltham Forest being able to do, but you look at the work that Lambeth are doing, you look at the work that's happening now in Westminster with the change of Islington are delivering stuff, you know, Hounslow in Outer London, Enfield in Outer London. You're seeing this change from embracing more boroughs, which will lead to more diversity. And then what is also key is funding. We have a small funding pot. We partner jointly with the London Marathon Foundation to fund community organisations. So these are small grants that go to community organisations to enable more people from diverse backgrounds to walk and cycle more. And a really good example of that is Cycle Sisters, which are working with women from the Muslim community to cycle more. They've now expanded into three or four different boroughs. Yep. It's those sort of that vanguard within the community that then bring other people along with it, and it all it leads to that sort of virtuous circle which leads to more people cycling.
That there is an issue there. All the boroughs you mentioned are actually Labour controlled, and there is a kind of split somewhat. Well, first of all, there's a political split, and there's an inner Outer London split, which to some extent match each other. So how do you manage to justify the fact that actually what you're doing is working with a lot of Labour boroughs and the Conservative boroughs are either against this or you're just ignoring them?
Well, I don't think that's actually true or fair, because there is work happening in some of the Conservative boroughs. If you look at, you know, we've been working on some routes in Harrow at the moment. When Westminster was Conservative, there was work happening in Westminster. So I think the party political piece is it's a slight misnomer. There are challenges around
Kensington and Chelsea. They blocked this. I mean, that's where I was brought up, and they've blocked. You know, they had a cycle route and they took it out, you know, in Kensington High Street, where I was brought up. So I felt particularly strongly about this. And there's no sign of it being reinstated.
I would agree with that. But I think that is down to that individual council rather than making blanket pieces on party politics on there. And so obviously that's where we continue to want to work with Kensington and Chelsea on putting a safe cycle route through the borough. If they're keen to do that, one of the challenges is that these are their roads. They're the highway authority for for those routes. And we've repeatedly offered up schemes and ways to work. So I think that's why it's so important that local people continue to campaign for that that route, because it will eventually, I'm convinced there will be change in that.
Yes, you've got a plan for Harland Park roundabout, which I go round to go watch Queen's Park Rangers.
Which isn't in Kensington and Chelsea.
Oh, is it not?
That's in Hammersmith and Fulham, on the TfL road.
Oh, right, okay.
But your wider point is that there is a difference between inner, central London, inner London, and outer London.
Yeah.
Central London, I think we can increasingly, if you look at the maps of the cycle routes, it's increasingly getting more dense. You can find your way around. Now, I'm not saying it's faultless. There are still big challenges in central London that need continual focus. Outer London has changed massively in the last 5 years. If you look at the, Hackney, Southwark, Lambeth, Lewisham,
that next ring of boroughs, yes, and that's
where
not
we've
the
seen massive growth.
Right.
I think the next challenge is going to be, and the next exciting part of this is bringing more cycling infrastructure to outer London. And now this is not going to be, I can't envisage people doing the entire loop around the boroughs. I think the different strategy is needed in outer London, increasingly looking at town centres. So if you look at the work that Enfield have done on their town centres, you've got routes coming into the town centre. Now that's good for, if people are cycling into town centres, that's good for reducing congestion, that's good for people's health, but it's also good for those shops and that local economy, because people who walk and cycle tend to spend more in those shops.
But how there is, I know you're trying to dodge it and you represent the whole of London, but there is a political divide here. And I just wonder, the arguments against more cycling and the LTNs and 20-mile-an-hour zones is that, this is war on the motorist. Most people have to drive around. You're kind of making it more difficult. How do you counter that argument?
Well, it's just nonsense. There is no war on the motorist. If you look at the number of roads that are across London, I can probably name, on two hands, the number of roads you can't actually drive down. Yeah. So there is no war on the motorist. This is about readjusting priorities. Our city, London's been designed for decades around private car use. Yeah. We can't continue to see the growth in private vehicles. There just simply isn't enough space. It's madness for the economy, it's madness for the environment, it's madness for the health of the city. So we have to do something. Now, the only way to challenge that is more walking, more cycling, and more public transport. Yep.
Right.
So investing in the bus lanes, absolutely vital. New tube systems, the Elizabeth Line demonstrates that. But we can't do it all with big new tube lines and that. Walking and cycling plays an absolutely fundamental role on that. And that just is going to be part of the future. We haven't got bike lanes on every road. Yep, they shouldn't be on every road. We do need freight corridors. We do need those essential journeys. But what we need is a safe network that enables people to make that choice. And this is all about choices. This is not enforcing anything. It's, do you want to cycle? A lot of people want to cycle. What's the biggest barrier? I don't feel safe. Yeah, how do we make them feel safe? We provide a bit of space on the roads or quite a back route so they can get around as part of their daily lives. Not for every journey. I don't cycle every journey. I don't walk every journey. Every so often I use my car. Yeah,
right.
But that is the sort of, it's about choices. And this is providing a choice that doesn't exist at the moment to everybody. And that's where we need to get to, that all Londoners have got access to a cycle network.
Okay, but how do you counter the argument? There is a limited amount of space. And there's certainly some people, bus campaigners sometimes, who say, well, if you're going to dedicate things to cycle lanes, you're going to slow the buses down.
Saying that you're going to put a bike lane on every main road, is not feasible and is not desirable. This is all about, if you look at how we do actually plan the transport in London, it's not like someone sitting with a crayon on an A to Z saying, this is what we're going to do. Although I do understand that's how things have been designed under previous administrations.
A to Z, I'm afraid, ages you, Will, but yes.
It does indeed, I wish I was part of that cohort of young men you were talking about,
right.
No longer. But, the strategic decision, saying there are some routes that, what are the priority routes for people to cycle? What are the priority routes for buses? Yep. And then you work through, well, actually, it makes more sense that this is a bus priority route and then this is a cycle route. There are solutions where you could both prioritise buses and cycling. So for a good example is Bishopsgate.
Yeah.
Right. You could do it on Stoke and Church Street. Both have seen huge improvements in bus time, journey times, as well as increases in cycling. Yep. And then at the limiting car usage. Yep. So there are different solutions for different roads. But what you need to keep in mind is, what is the outcome we're trying to get here? More walking, more cycling, more public transport. What routes enable the biggest shift? And then how do we prioritise for the right modes and the right roads?
So you don't think there's a conflict between bus lanes and cycle lanes?
I don't think there always has to be a conflict between bus lanes and cycle lanes. I think that actually what we want to be doing is actually prioritising both and trying to people to shift out of their cars. Now, I know there are some campaigners who bang on endlessly about bus speeds going down and it's all down to cycling and the cycling infrastructure. The data just doesn't stack up on that. Actually, the bus speeds have remained relatively consistent. The biggest challenge affecting the bus network are roadworks. Yep, and unplanned roadworks, particularly on borough roads. 80% of the delays are down to that. So that's why we now have a team coordinating the roadworks. We need to really address the real problems that are causing problems, the real issues that are causing the problems of congestion, not just going on, oh, it's all down to cycle lanes, it's all down to this. No, the real challenge is how we actually keep how we manage the roadworks and the changes that are happening on the streets to enable the journey times to remain consistent.
You mentioned low traffic neighbourhoods at the beginning. You know, there are campaigners against low traffic neighbourhoods who argue that all that does is push people onto main roads where poorer people tend to live, and it makes the residential, more affluent areas kind of nicer for cyclists and walkers, but actually it's to the great detriment of people living on main roads. You clearly support LTNs. How do you counter that argument?
Well, again, some of it's just not true. You know, it's amazing how myths just seem to, and sort of conspiracy theories and myths seem to inform so much public discourse. You know, this idea that 15-minute cities, you're all going to be, you know, not allowed to be able to travel more than 15, is a prime example of how these myths have perpetuated into policy. And I think low traffic neighbourhoods have been a victim of this. That most low traffic neighbourhoods, the evidence stacks up to show that actually what they do is reduce the number of local car journeys, because people do walk, people do cycle, yep, and that has an impact on those boundary roads as well. If you look at most low traffic neighbourhoods across the road, they've seen an increase in walking, an increase in cycling, a decrease in traffic with no major impacts on the boundary roads. Yep.
The anti-campaigners will contest that. They'll say that's not shown up in the statistics. You're showing that statistics definitely
across the board, that is right. The case. Now, there are always exceptions. There have been some cases where there have been increases on some of the boundary roads, and that's where TfL needs to work with the boroughs to look at, well, how can that be improved so that we don't have those problems. But I think one of the challenges that happened with the low traffic neighbourhoods was the way that they were introduced during COVID came as a, you know, the rapid rollout of that. I think we've learned from that, and the key thing here is actually engaging with the communities, boroughs working with TfL to jointly plan these things rather than for them to be sort of delivered on a much more ad hoc basis.
Okay, that brings us nicely to the last question. We're going to have a mayoral election. What do you think the ambition for the next 4-year mayoral term is in London? I mean, where do you see the emphasis, assuming that we get a reasonably pro-cycling administration, where do you think the emphasis ought to be? You said you've increased from 90 kilometres to 350. Is that programme continuing, or is it more on outer borough stuff, outer London borough stuff, or where will the focus be?
So I'm not a political appointee, and obviously, I'm not an elected representative. Right. But the need, you know, if you look at what actually we need to do to achieve the outcomes we want to do, which is essentially about making London a sustainable, competitive city where people want to live. People want to live, people want to work, people want to bring up their kids. The challenges haven't changed. What people want is cleaner air, safer roads, yep, so their kids can walk and cycle to school without having the risk of being hit by a car. We want a roads that are not congested so that the economy can function and people can get around by buses if they, you know, and that sort of thing. The needs haven't changed. We need to mitigate against climate change. So the needs haven't changed. The programme, however, does need to evolve. Yep, we've been very successful in some areas of London where we build the infrastructure for the cycle network. What we've seen is the number of people cycling soar, the risk go down. Yep.
Right.
But at the moment, that is not across all of London. Not all Londoners have access to that. I think there's a real challenge on inequalities here, working with communities that are poorer, that have got more ethnic diversity, those groups that are historically less likely to walk and cycle. Now, that's where the emphasis is. And there certainly needs to be a strategic focus on outer London that combines with public transport. Yeah, you're not going to cycle. Very few people are going to cycle from Barking to Hounslow. Yeah, right. But yeah, they might cycle into Barking Town Centre, into Romford Tent Centre, into Orpington, right, into Bromley. Yep. How do we work with that? Or into the tube station so that they can cycle to the train station and then get the train on their way. So there's a different strategy required for outer London, and I'm really excited about delivering that.
And do you think this is going to be more the focus for another 4-year term? I mean, assuming whoever becomes mayor.
But I can't, you know, it depends on Londoners if they want it, but I think that the need is there. There is obviously a huge amount that needs to continue to happen to maintain the progress, and outer London has to be, you know, not, this is not saying there's no more work to be done in central London. Some of the junctions need sorting out. There are real concerns around safety in some areas. Inner London is still a bit of a patchwork, but what we need to do is continue to deliver that network, densify it where it's needed, make those links and connections between the routes. But where you look at that map at the moment, there is a big white space in outer London, and that I think needs to begin to get filled up to enable people to make the same choices that they've been doing in inner London in outer London.
Well, Will, thank you very much. That's greatly enlightening, and I'm sure our listeners will have a lot of thoughts about that. So thank you very much for that. I'm in the House of Commons, where I've just been at the launch of a very interesting initiative by Southeastern Trains, which has launched its Social Mobility Action Plan. And this is the first of its kind in the rail industry, and I thought I'd ask Steve White, the MD of Southeastern Trains, what it's all about. So, Steve, tell me, what's all this social mobility thingy about?
Well, it's a great opportunity for a big organisation like Southeastern to really give opportunities to people within our business and also within our communities. You know, we think railways are much more than simply getting people from A to B. We think they can offer social inclusion, we think they can offer environmental sustainability, we think we can offer economic growth. But looking at this in more detail, we also think we can give opportunities to people in deprived areas to come and have a fabulous career in a brilliant industry.
You've produced a lengthy report on this. What's the basic kind of most important aspects you want to bring out about it?
Well, we've been working with the Purpose Coalition, which is led by Justin Greening. It's a cross-party coalition, and they have a number of levelling up goals, 14 levelling up goals, which are designed to make society basically fairer. We've assessed our business against 6 of those levelling up goals to see what we already do, and we've identified through their recommendations areas where we can do more. That includes providing leadership on the subject of mental health, which is so critical these days, and it includes giving better opportunities to people within our organisation, particularly from underrepresented groups. And it also includes doing an outreach programme to schools and colleges in the most deprived areas on our network to give them a route into employment, you know, when they leave school.
So is this something that you should be doing as a railway company? I mean, you know, you're a railway company, you're supposed to run trains. Is social mobility something you should be paying attention to?
Yeah, we honestly think it is. I mean, we attract a public subsidy of over £400 million a year. We believe that if we're spending taxpayers' money, we should spend it wisely. We should provide the best possible train service to get people from A to B. But as our railway, we're going to recruit 600 people this year to join Southeastern. Why shouldn't we recruit people from underrepresented areas, from areas of deprivation, and give opportunities to people that, you know, is within our gift to do. It's good for our business to be a better reflection of the community we serve, and it can be done relatively inexpensively. It's part of this is a mindset shift rather than about opening the checkbook.
Oh, right. So this is not going to cost a lot of money, but it's just a better way of doing things?
Exactly. If we're going to go and recruit 600 new people this year, where are we going to go and look for them? Where are we going to find them? Are we going to give people, you know, that leg up in society? If we take a different approach, it won't be a more expensive way of recruiting, but it will bring into our business greater diversity. You know, we have a huge issue at the moment in terms of the railway being very male dominated and with a very significant age demographic. As we replace those people who choose to retire, we want to make our railway increasingly inclusive and diverse and reflective of the society that we serve. And if we do that primarily by focusing on areas of deprivation, that can only be a good thing for society.
So how did you get into this? Why? And you're pioneering, you're the first. I mean, how come you came into this?
We are. Well, we got an introduction to the Purpose Coalition, and the more we listened to the agenda and we heard about it, the more we just wanted to be on board. As I'm sure you'll be aware, some of the things that South Eastern have done, like bringing in the Rail to Refuge scheme or launching the Rail Industry Mental
Health
Charter.
Oh, yes, I remember that, yes.
You know, we love doing things to help others. And the Purpose Coalition, you know, really is a story that resonated to us. You know, we think that what they stand for, you know, we would naturally embrace. And what we're doing now, we're working with the Purpose Coalition and other like-minded organisations, some public, some private, to try and amplify what we can do together to really help social mobility. The biggest challenge that most companies are going to face in the next decade is where is the pipeline of talent coming from? You know, post-Brexit, you know, in the world we live in today, there's quite a tight labour market and there's a lot of people that are due to retire in the next decade. So if we're going to bring in a new pipeline of talent, where should that best be sourced? And how can we use it as an opportunity, you know, to literally transform people's lives? We did something recently with the Prince's Trust, and one of my colleagues who was a mentor, Eric, described today that one of the people on the Prince's Trust program did literally not have enough money to buy any food on the day they came to spend with us. But 7 of the 10 people that did that program have been offered full-time jobs on Southeastern. They've now got a proper salary, they've got a pension, they've got travel facilities, they're part of a community, a railway family, and they've got the self-esteem that comes with earning your own money. You know, that's genuinely transformational.
Because they might have been the sort of people who might never have found you, as it were.
Exactly.
Or had the confidence to apply.
Exactly. The Prince's Trust have provided 2 cohort ports for us this year, one London-centric and one Kent-centric, all of which were young people, unemployed, and with whose prospects were potentially limited. And they came to us for a 3-week programme where they learnt about the railways, got some personal skills, but at the end of it, those who were able to pass the assessment have now been interviewed and offered full-time jobs. So we have helped transform a small number of lives out of all recognition, and we know we can do much more of that. We really know we can do much more of that. If we partner with other organisations and we have the mindset to search in the right places for the right people.
But so, well, the obvious last question is, shouldn't other railway companies be doing this? And shouldn't it be something that may be picked up by the Labour Party if they get into government?
Yeah, the beauty of the Purpose Coalition is it's cross-party work. So we would like, if there is a change of government, we like this work to continue seamlessly. We expect one of the things that the Labour Party might do is deal with socio-economic as a protected characteristic. So we think the Labour Party would fully support this agenda, and indeed some of the work that's being done on breaking down barriers is all about, you know, giving that opportunity to people who need it more than others. So yes, we think the Labour Party will adopt it, but to answer your question candidly, I'd love to see more railway companies adopt this approach. It's proportionate, it's beneficial, and it's just a good thing to do. And we need to show society that railways are a force for good. Last couple of years have been challenging, but moving forward, you know, this is part of our agenda that says, you know, railways are good organisations that do good things, And if we can provide social mobility as well as pure mobility, you know, people will like that.
Well, so it's not just altruism, it's good for the railways. Steve White, Managing Director of South Eastern, thank you very much. That's a fantastic kind of scheme, and let's hope that other people pick it up. Thank you.
Thank you, Christian.
Here's Christian's final thought from the departure lounge.
Well, as regular listeners know, I am obsessed with driverless cars, and indeed wrote a book about them called Driverless Cars on a Road to Nowhere a few years ago. And I note that the New York Times has now found that Apple, which has spent a cool $100 billion on trying to develop, first of all, a sort of clever electric car, and then it gave up on that and has gone for an autonomous car, and then didn't quite know what it was doing, but kept on spending vast amounts of money. And now it's given up on that program totally. And somebody tweeted, and I must say I'm very proud of this, somebody tweeted that Apple could have saved themselves $100 billion if they'd read my book, which was published 5 years ago, which said precisely that driverless cars are, you know, probably impossible and certainly never going to become the mass thing that had been promised. So Apple have now pulled out completely, and it leaves, there's still kind of two companies in there, Cruise, which is owned by GM, but which have retreated greatly after that incident in San Francisco where one of their cars ran over a woman who'd already been knocked over by another car. And Waymo is the only really big player standing, and that's kind of part of Google. And actually, I bet in the next few months or years, I'm going to report the fact that Waymo will also have largely given up on the whole idea of ensuring that we're all in driverless cars and that this is the future. So watch this space, but you know, the driverless car boom is about to bust.
Calling All Stations, the transport podcast with Christian Walmar, is produced by Cogitamus Limited, a leading provider of public affairs consultancy services in the sector. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you have, please consider giving us a 5-star rating with whichever platform you use. Do also follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our handle is @AllStationsPod.